It's good to see everybody here this morning. As is our custom, at least this year, one of our goals was to deal with lessons by request, that questions that people have about the Bible, about religion in general, about God, getting those questions answered. And one of the questions I've had recently has been about charity. So we're going to be talking about that this morning, and we'll get into that in just a moment. Chad mentioned just a few moments ago about Christians around the world who are facing disaster and who have faced incredible loss. You know, normally, and I hate to speak from the perspective of somebody who's had such a comfortable and blessed life, but maybe you can understand a little bit when I say that normally we think of those in disasters as being on television. That it's always somebody else who gets caught up in the disaster, and we see from a distance those who've been affected by hurricanes and earthquakes or civil wars and man-made disasters of that kind. We see them on TV and we feel sympathy for them and we try to participate in any way that we can from the other side of the world in relief efforts, and that's good and that should be how it is. Until the disaster hits you much closer to home. And then suddenly people affected by natural disasters and war and other things, they're not just people on TV. They're people that you know and people that you care about. My aunt and her family, my mom's sister, live in a town called Orange, Texas, which is in southeast Texas. And as the rains were coming from the remnants of the hurricane this last week, she saw throughout the night, the rain come up to her driveway and then creep up halfway across her lawn and then right up to the edge of her house and then into her house. And then it was 1 foot and 2 feet and 3 feet. They had to go and sleep, or really, she said, they didn't sleep at all. They attempted to sleep in the treehouse in their backyard as they watched the water eventually get to 6 feet around them. They were rescued and they were brought to a dry, safe place. And eventually, a member of the church in that area took them in to their homes, and they're safe and sound now, just at the point of assessing the damage once the water recedes. And again, it's easy to see that stuff on TV and feel a sort of a distance until it really hits you close to home. And I'm very close to my aunt. I love her very much, and I think that her needs are being taken care of at this point. But that really, again, brought it close to home when you talk about charity and what we're supposed to do and what is our obligation to, especially other Christians in our congregation and around the world. So let's deal with this question today of what does the Bible say about Christians practicing charity? Well, let's start with a biblical precedent first and foremost, because obviously, if we want to truly reflect Christ in a fallen world, we need to start with what Christ and His apostles have said on any given subject. So whether the message comes straight from Jesus' own mouth or from one of His disciples or one of the prophets in the Bible, that is what represents what Christ wants and what Christ expects out of us on this subject. So in Galatians 6 and verse 10, the apostle Paul had this to say, "So then while we have opportunity, let us do good to all men, especially to those who are of the household of faith." Now, one thing to point out from this passage is that while we have opportunity, certainly seems like all the time. There's always going to be opportunity, as we're going to look at in a scripture here in just a few minutes. In Galatians 2 and verse 10, Paul said, "They only asked us to remember the poor, the very thing I also was eager to do." What I like about that passage is that Paul makes it clear that he doesn't have to be told twice to have some concern and love for the poor. That was already on his mind. And the fact that Peter and James and the other apostles in Jerusalem had to tell him that was kind of a non-issue. He already wanted to help the poor. He didn't have to have somebody poke and prod him into helping the poor. Do we have the same attitude about practicing our charity? Jesus said in Matthew chapter 26, verses 10 and 11, "For the poor you shall have with you always." And that's going back to the idea of we will have opportunity. Wherever there's opportunity is always. There's always going to be people who are poor. And I don't believe that Jesus is being cynical when he says that the poor you will have with you always. He's not being cynical or bitter about that fact. I think Jesus is simply pointing out the reality of life on planet Earth, that this is a fallen world that's affected by sin, and it's affected by corruption, that there is plague, that there is natural disaster, and those things will happen inevitably and eventually. You might even say in some way to us all. Now, you might never be affected by a hurricane here in Phoenix, Arizona, at least in your own person and your own property. But you're going to know people in places like Houston who are affected by hurricanes. Maybe we don't have earthquakes very often here in the valley. I've not felt one in 4 years, just myself. But we know people in California who might be affected by it. Not only that, but there's an interconnectivity in all the world when it comes to the economy. Did you notice the gas price bump up a little bit this last week because of the refineries affected in Southeast Texas? There are ways that we're all affected by natural disaster, by plague, by disease, by famine, and by civil war in countries around the world. We need to be sensitive to the fact that we're all affected by that. And the poor you shall have with you always, straight from Jesus' own mouth. Now, he's quoting, I believe, from Deuteronomy 15, at least summing up the idea from Deuteronomy 15, verses 9 through 11. And again, when this was written in Deuteronomy, this wasn't written out of some cynicism about the poor. It was written to remind them that you're always going to have to look out for them. You're always going to have to be in tune to the needs of the people around you. That you might help somebody this year, but next year will come along and somebody else will need to be helped then. So it says, for the poor will never cease to be in your land. Therefore, I command you, saying, you shall freely open your hand to your brother, to your needy and the poor in your land. So let's kind of take this apart here and look at the obligation that we have as a congregation to the poor. And then we'll look at the obligations we have as individuals to the poor. There is no biblical precedent, first of all, for corporate benevolence on behalf of unbelievers. And that's something that we need to keep in mind, that when folks ask us, do you have a food kitchen here or a food bank of some kind, does the Monte Vista Church of Christ as a group of people help the unbelievers in your community? And the answer is no, because there's no biblical precedent for it. There's no Bible authority, no New Testament Bible authority for us as a group to take care of the unbelievers in our community. Now, there's an individual obligation that we have that we'll talk about later. So what then is the group responsibility? If not to everybody out in the world, what is our congregational responsibility? Well, we have this incredible list of passages that we can look at. An incredible body of evidence, a consistent pattern from verse to verse to verse in the New Testament that indicates our obligation is to our own brethren as a group. Again, there will be things we talk about on an individual basis later on, but as a group, we have scriptural authority consistently in the pattern of the New Testament to take care of Christians. I'll give you a few examples here, and this is not an exhaustive list just for the sake of time, but in Acts chapter 4 and verses 32 through 35, it says that there was not a needy person among them in their practicing of congregational charity. Not a needy person among them indicates to me that the people they were taking care of were in their own group. Among them, it's the same language that's talked about in 1 Peter chapter 5 when it talks about elders shepherding the flock among you. So if an elder's authority only extends to the congregation among him, then the charity that we practice as a group only extends to those who are among us as a group. In Acts chapter 11 and verse 29, the collection that was taken up there was for the relief of the brethren living in Judea. So they could take care of brethren in a faraway land, but the relief was limited to the brethren, to other Christians. 1 Corinthians 16 and verse 1, perhaps referring to the same collection, it says the collection for whom? The collection for the saints, not the collection for everybody, but the collection that was taken up specifically for Christians. Acts chapter 2, verses 44 and 45, right after the day of Pentecost, 3,000 people were baptized on that day, and you suddenly have the birth of a massive congregation of Christians. And when you read in Acts chapter 2, 44 and 45, the benevolence and charity that was practiced among them within their own congregation. Acts chapter 6, verses 1 through 8. There were needy widows in the congregation in Jerusalem. And it's clear from the text that it was only widows who were Christians there in Jerusalem who were being given support from the collection that was being taken up as a congregation. In 2 Corinthians 8 and verse 4, the support of the saints, again, the saints specifically. 2 Corinthians 9 verse 1, the ministry to the saints. Romans chapter 15, verses 25 and 26 is exclusive in nature as well. Only the poor and needy who are members of the church in Jerusalem were to receive the funds being sent. And in 1 Timothy chapter 5, verses 3 through 10, Paul describes the way that churches are allowed to take care of the widows who are widows indeed among them. And it's interesting, isn't it, that all these stipulations are put on widows in 1 Timothy chapter 5, that a widow is to be taken care of if she meets these qualifications. So I find it interesting that Paul, the apostle, would put all these qualifications on helping a widow who's in your own congregation, and yet Paul would be okay with the idea of practicing just complete open charity to anybody who shows up at your food bank to take whatever he or she wants. You don't know them, you don't know their story, you don't know their reputation. So it's actually easier, if that's true, it would be easier to be a complete stranger and an unbeliever to get charity from the church than a widow who has all of these qualifications to meet in 1 Timothy chapter 5. So I just find it hard to believe that Paul would be okay with just complete open-ended, indiscriminate charity from the congregation to unbelievers. Now, with all that being said, this seems like that's a lot of rules, very restrictive. And yet, isn't there enough work to be done among Christians in the world as it is? And the fact remains that the church is the church. It is an organization that was created by God, instituted by God, established on the authority of Jesus Christ in the foundation of the elder and the apostles in Jerusalem. It's His organization, and it's His to do with as He pleases. And if God stipulates that the church is supposed to work in a certain way, within certain bounds, we must respect that. Now, do you expect the Boy Scouts to be anything more than the Boy Scouts? Do you show up at a Boy Scout troop meeting expecting to find advice on how to hook up your electronics in your house? No, because that isn't within the purview of what the Boy Scouts do. Do you show up at the grocery store, at any Fry's grocery store, asking for medical advice from the cashier at Fry's? No, because that's not within the purview of what a cashier at Fry's does. Now, you could flip that around. Do you show up at your doctor's office expecting to find canned beans? No, because that isn't what your doctor does. So it's interesting, isn't it, that we expect our doctors to be our doctors, and we expect our grocery stores to be our grocery stores, and the Boy Scouts to be the Boy Scouts. And we're okay with the limitations of those organizations. And yet, when it comes to the church, and we see verse after verse after verse that says, when you take up a collection, it's for Christians, for the saints in Jerusalem, for the needy saints, ministry to the saints. That's a phrase that's used over and over and over again, and there's not a single verse that gives us authority for anything else. Why do we expect the church to be more than what God has designed the church to be? There's enough needy Christians in Sierra Leone to keep us busy for years. And there's enough needy Christians in the Houston area to keep us busy for years. And there's enough needy Christians here at Monte Vista, just among 200 people in this building, to keep us busy for years. There's enough needy Christians out there. That's a big enough job on its own. Now, is there an obligation that we have as individuals to all people, not just citizens of the kingdom? In James chapter 1 and verse 27, it says, "This is pure and undefiled religion in the sight of our God and Father, to visit orphans and widows in their distress, and to keep oneself unstained by the world." Now, the reason why I think that this is individual in nature, if this is corporate in nature, if this is what a church is supposed to do, take care of any widows and any orphans out there in all the world, then any church that does not have at least two widows and at least two orphans on its church budget isn't practicing true religion. Or a church that doesn't have the financial capability to help out two widows and at least two orphans must not be practicing true religion. James is speaking of the individual's obligation to the needy out there in the world. There will always be widows and there will always be orphans out there to take care of. And you, as an incredibly blessed American Christian, you will always have at least something that you can do to help them. It says in Galatians 6 and verse 10, "So then, while we have opportunity, let us do good to all men, and especially to those who are of the household of faith." Now, if you read in Galatians chapter 6, the entire chapter is individual in nature. It speaks of you, singular, throughout the chapter. The whole chapter speaks of the individual Christian and what the individual Christian must do to practice his or her Christianity in an effective and useful manner. And part of doing that is practicing charity, even to unbelievers, to people out there in the world, and to leave a certain impression on them about what it means to be a Christian. One practical application to all of this is that when your benevolence is individual in nature, I think it makes much more of a difference than when it comes from an organization. You know, people can take advantage of organizations. I know they can take advantage of individuals, but it's a lot easier to take advantage of organizations. It's easy to take charity from an organization that's kind of faceless, right? It's just the name of an organization. You can take food from a food bank and walk away without feeling a whole lot of guilt if you don't ever have any relationship with that food bank. But when charity is practiced on an individual basis, when there's a name and a face and a personality that's attached to that charity, you leave much more of an impression on unbelievers out there. When you can say, in all honesty and all purity, when you help somebody and you say, "Now you understand, this is coming from my own pocket. This isn't coming from an organization. This isn't coming from some kind of faceless institution. If I'm going to help you out, buddy, if I'm going to help you out, friend, this is coming from my own pocket. This is from me to you. And by the way, I'd love to also share the gospel with you." It's interesting, isn't it? It's a whole lot harder to kind of be impersonal when the personal element is so obvious in the exchange of charity. And I think your personal evangelism is going to be much more effective when it is coupled with benevolence on an individual basis rather than anything else, especially on an organizational or institutional basis. Not only that, but I think that we have a civic duty when it comes to helping and assisting the impoverished in our own community. When we as individuals practice charity, we leave an impression on the people around us that's very hard to deny. In 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 15 through 17, for example, Peter has this to say, "For such is the will of God, that by doing right, you may silence the ignorance of foolish men. Act as free men, and do not use your freedom as a covering for evil, but use it as bond slaves of God." Now, that's a powerful message to me. That's a very powerful message. There's a lot of things the world thinks about Christians. A lot of impressions that they have about Christians. That we're strange or that we're backward, that we don't understand the way the world works, that we don't believe in science, right? I mean, that's always one of those strange accusations, isn't it? But then you turn on the news and you watch the way that people treat each other in a place like Houston where it's flooding. And you scroll through Facebook. And I'm friends with a lot of preachers on Facebook just because of the nature of my work. We have a lot of connections on the internet. And it brings me to tears. It really does. I have to be careful not to cry right now. but it brings me to tears to see some of the way my friends have said, hey, just so everyone knows, I'm going down with about a dozen of us from our congregation. We're loading up the back of a truck, and we're going down with bottles of water and tools and shovels to dig people out, to help people to take the drywall out of their houses. Dozens and dozens of my friends, people I know personally. So I can attest to the way that Christians take care of people. And that means something. So maybe Christians are strange and we're backward and we believe that Genesis is real and literal and we believe that Jesus was raised from the dead and we believe that God is going to come judge the world and we believe in this magical fairy tale land called heaven. Say what you want about Christians. But when Christians practice their faith in the real world, that has to mean something to people. Even the most stubborn, hard-hearted unbeliever has to admit that the Christian faith does things. It does things in this world. Change people's impression of Christianity by the way that you practice your faith. Show them what true and undefiled religion really looks like. So let's talk about some considerations at this point, because I think really what we want to know is not just the precedent in the Bible for practicing charity. I don't think anybody in this assembly today had any doubts about what our congregational obligations were, about what our individual obligations were. I think more of the questions that we have is, how do you really go about doing this? How do you take this from the page of the Bible to in practice in real life? We have to be really careful, and here's my first point I want to make along these lines, is be really careful about allowing unbridled enthusiasm to lead you down some improper path. Because I was talking about watching the news earlier and seeing the way that people are so good and take care of each other on the news. Well, the other thing you see on the news is reports of people taking advantage of those in need. It sure doesn't take long. You get the first responders to go in there first. You get the people who want to help, just the volunteers who come in second. And what's usually the third wave of human beings who come in after that? It's the swindlers and the shysters. That's the third wave of people that typically show up also. And in our innocent enthusiasm, we'll see some link on Facebook that says, want to help those in need? And we go, huh? All you have to do is donate $5. Okay, click the link and done it, and I've helped. And there are institutions out there, there are organizations out there that have a good reputation, supposedly, but when you really dig into it, you find out the CEO makes $1 million a year. Or when you really dig into it, you find out that only one out of $100 or one penny on the dollar actually goes to people in need, and the rest of it goes to administrative things within this supposedly nonprofit organization. If we're going to be good stewards of our blessings, we have to do some research and make sure that when you're practicing charity, that you know what the charity is doing. Know where your money is going. As Jesus put it in Matthew chapter 10 and verse 16, be as shrewd as serpents, but innocent as doves. Those two things might seem opposite, right? But Jesus says, you have to find a way to put those together. To be as shrewd as serpents, but innocent as doves. Matthew chapter 7 and verse 6 is even more striking when Jesus says in his Sermon on the Mount, do not give what is holy to dogs, do not throw your pearls before swine, lest they trample them under their feet and turn around and tear you to pieces. So here are some considerations to keep in mind as you practice your charity. When choosing a charity, be very careful that it's not going to use your money to promote something that's false. A lot of charities out there are religious in nature, and I don't have a problem with that necessarily as long as what they're teaching isn't false. Sometimes, again, in our enthusiasm, we'll send our money to an organization, but when you really dig into it, you find out that the message that they're presenting along with the charity is not a biblical message. So yes, they give food and blankets and shelter, but while the people are there receiving food, blankets, and safety and shelter, they're also being given pamphlets or they're being taught something that's not biblical. So again, be really careful that if you're going to give to a religious charity of some kind, know what it is that they teach, especially on something like salvation. Otherwise, you're participating in something that's false, that might teach somebody a false view or a false impression of salvation or the gospel. Like 2 Corinthians 6 and verse 14 says, "Don't be bound together with unbelievers, for what partnership have righteousness and lawlessness, or what fellowship has light with darkness?" Your money is your money. We see that later on in the book of Acts, in Acts chapter 5 and verse 4, where Peter confronts those two individuals who gave in a dishonest way. He says, as long as the property was yours, it was yours, and it was under your control. The same is true of us. It's your money. Know where your money is going. So be really careful about that. If you have to, find secular charities that are going to take care of people's physical and psychological or professional needs. That way you're not worried about some false idea or some false religious concept that's being taught along with the charity. Second, find a cause that you really care about. I think it's important for us to have an emotional stake in the work that a charity is doing. And the more emotionally invested you are in what a charity is doing, perhaps, the more financially you will be willing to get invested in that charity. Along those same lines, there's nothing wrong with giving to a charity that's not necessarily focused on human beings. Now, I think we need to take care of human beings first and foremost, that their lives and their safety and their well-being should be most important to us. But there's certainly nothing wrong, there's nothing sinful, I don't think there's anything inappropriate about taking care of charities that care about animals as well, or care about environmentalism, at least in a responsible way, environmentally speaking, or that care about civic things, the beautification of a city or the safety of a city, things that take care of organizations or structures within a city. There are plenty of charities out there that aren't necessarily focused on a human being's personal physical needs, and those charities are important also. Be extremely cautious about strangers. I cannot emphasize this enough, my friends. We've all been there at the gas station, haven't we? You're pumping gas into your car and the person comes up with some story that may or may not be true. I don't want to be cynical about it, but it may or may not be true. You have to be cautious about things like that. Extremely cautious about things like that. Rather than giving money, my recommendation is this. Find some material need that needs to be filled. If they say that they're hungry, my recommendation is keep $5 gift cards in your car at all times. Keep two or three $5 gift cards to Subway or McDonald's or grocery stores. Have some kind of material need so that if they say they're hungry, you're not just giving money that can be used for anything. You're actually giving something that's used for food. You say you're hungry, this right here will provide that meal for you. That way you as a Christian know where your money is going and you know that it can't be used for something that's sinful or something that's inappropriate. So have some control over it. If people are thirsty, keep water bottles in your car, especially during the summertime. If they're thirsty, you've always got a water bottle, reach around the back of your seat and hand a water bottle out your front window. You know, one thing that somebody told me, in an interview with a number of homeless individuals, they came up with a list of the things that homeless people love more than anything else. And one of the surprising things was clean socks. Clean socks. I hadn't always thought about that, but the idea of having clean socks is something that we all take for granted. And a package of socks from Walmart is not going to cost you more than a couple of bucks. So maybe that's something that you can do. Keep in the trunk of your cars. Just have a package of clean, new socks that you can give out to people. Things like that. Lots of things that they're material needs. You don't have to give money. You can always give material things as well. Never allow strangers into your home or your car. And I know that we want to be kind and charitable, but you've got to draw a line somewhere. You have to draw a line somewhere. You want to do the right thing and help people, but you have to draw a line somewhere. Never allow strangers into your home or your car. I don't care what their sob story is. Never allow strangers into your home or your car. There's always an alternative. There is always an alternative. I've had people knock on the front door of the church building. I've had people knock on the front door of my home in different places where we've lived, and they ask for this or they ask for that. Have a registry in your mind or keep a few phone numbers near the door of places that can help individuals out. Homeless shelters or nearby gas stations that have a clean restroom that's welcoming to people who walk in. If somebody knocks on your door and says, "Hey, I need to use your bathroom real quick," Is there a gas station 5 minutes away that you can direct them to instead of allowing a potential threat into your home? We have to be so careful about this, and we have to be careful not to be so naive that we welcome a potential danger into our home and around our families. And we need to help people realize that charity doesn't stop after the first 24 hours of a catastrophe. In our enthusiasm, we throw a bunch of money onto things like the Red Cross right now, and we think the job is done. My Aunt Mary is going to have to rebuild for years. She has two cars that were totaled and a house that had 6 feet of water. Everything she had was ruined. Even things that she thought she put up high enough, she thought the water would go up to 3 feet. So she put things on her tables and tried to get them out of the way. There's just nowhere you can put your stuff when you've got 6 feet of water. And she's going to have needs for years. And there are probably 500,000 people just like her in that area who are going to have needs for years. So let's keep that in mind as well, that the need doesn't just stop after 24 hours. We need to check in on people and find out, what are you going to need 6 months from now? What are you going to need next week? What are you going to need a year from now? And the people that you know or situations that you're aware of, just be aware of that and try to practice your charity in a way that's extensive, that goes beyond just what happened yesterday, but goes into what happens later on. Let's not forget, and this is my last point, let's not forget that we have a greater obligation than people's food and clothing and shelter. And those things are important. Those things are important. It is very hard for someone to think about spiritual things when they're hungry, cold, and in danger. In fact, it's nearly impossible to think about spiritual things when you have some physical need that is so pressing. So we do need to take care of people's food and clothing and shelter. But we need to talk about their souls as well. Charity only helps somebody in the here and now when the charity is physical in nature. In Acts chapter 3, verses 1 through 10, Peter and the other apostles were going into the temple at the hour of prayer, and they encountered an individual who was begging from them. Now Peter stops and looks at the man, and the man stops and looks up at him, thinking he's going to get something, reaches his hand out to receive charity. And Peter says, look at me. Do I look like I have silver and gold to give you? I got empty pockets also. But I do have something I can give you. I can give you Jesus Christ. Now he healed the man of his lameness, and that's one thing, but the greater thing that he did for that individual was that he taught him the gospel. And he leapt up for joy because he could use his legs, but from that day forward, he clung to Peter and the apostles because he knew that that was where salvation was. Anybody who had the power to heal a man's legs, anybody who had that kind of power, could surely have the power to forgive sins and to ensure salvation for all eternity. Let's teach people the gospel also. In our hurry to help them with their physical needs, let's not forget the greater spiritual need that everybody has. Now, if you're not a Christian here this morning, you really ought to be. We give opportunity after every lesson to respond to the message of the gospel. In short, Mark 16, verse 16 says, he who believes and is baptized shall be saved. So if you have any spiritual need at all, then please let it be known by coming forward as we stand and sing.